Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Welcome to Curious with Josh Peck. Start the show.
Welcome back to the Curious Podcast. My name is Josh Peck and I'm your host and your name is Listener. And that's what you do. You listen. And thank God for that, because then I'm just alone talking into a microphone in my room, probably in my closet with something like some sort of head covering, because I don't want like the government's sort of radioactive brainwaves to mind read my thoughts. And that'd be a sad day for me. And I think that if I relapse on drugs and alcohol, that could be a real reality for a guy like me. You know, I'm sober 12 years, but when I wasn't, a certain level of crazy came out. I mean, I was always good old Josh. I wasn't one of those people where, like, you know, you look into my eyes and you're like, is he even there? Where'd he go? No. Understandably, I was still Josh, but I was not a great version of myself. Like, if this is Josh 2.0 talking to you right now, I was like Josh 0.3. Like, Josh, I need a lot of work and perhaps some charcoal pills, a week of sleep, like 18,000 calories and some prayer to get better. But I got all those things and now I'm doing great. I'm a little bit overweight. I'm training right now for a TV show that I'm doing. I mean, I'm not training because we're in quarantine, but I'm like, you know, I'm working out at home. I'm going for runs and whatnot, or whatever it is I'm allowed to do because the reasons. So I'm trying to stay in shape, but I'm trying not to eat like a big fat pig. And it's, it proves challenging. Listen, we all know my past because I bring it up all the time, but we all know that I come from big people. And that I was a big man myself at one time. But now, you know, I've sort of gotten it. I'm sort of like at a resting level of fitness, which I feel good about. But then as soon as you're like, oh, I actually need to be like TV fit, like proper, you know, leading. I feel corny saying that. But like, you know, just a proper actor fit, like a little bit underweight and a little bit, you know, cut up on the arms. And looks good in a tank top and perhaps has like 3 out of the 6 abdomen muscles showing. It's work. It takes a lot of work. It's really not great. It's hard. And you can't eat the things you want to eat. And you have to work out more than you think you should have to. And that's not, I'm not enjoying it. But I'm, you know, I'm doing it. And then there are mornings where I wake up where the lighting in my bathroom is just right and I catch myself from like the perfect angle. And maybe it's because, you know, when you wake up, your vision's not totally clear. And thus, like, I'll actually see my body with this perfect lighting and through very flawed eyesight and think, not bad, not bad, not great, not bad. And for a guy like me, not bad is a goal. So I'm flourishing. On today's show, Dave Rubin. Dave is an American conservative political commentator. He's a comedian. He just finished touring with Jordan Peterson all over the world. He has a YouTube show and a podcast called The Rubin Report. And he has a new book coming out, Don't Burn This Book, Thinking for Yourself in the Age of Unreason, that comes out April 28th. And I've actually included a link to buy the book in the liner notes. So check that out. Again, it's called Don't Burn This Book, Thinking for Yourself in the Age of Unreason. Now, the truth is that Dave and I don't agree on a lot. In fact, we agree on very little, but I think there's one thing that we both completely see eye to eye on, and that's having a safe place for healthy debate and discourse. And the idea that, you know, when you're exchanging ideas, even if they don't align, it allows for a better understanding of where that person's coming from. And perhaps it, even if you don't walk away from the conversation agreeing with each other, you have a better understanding of the way in which their mind works and how they've arrived at the conclusions that they have. Dave and I met through our friend, Bob Saget, who both, you know, had both of us at his wedding. And I don't mean to brag, but I know where your head went, which is like, wow. Dave and Josh went to Bob's wedding. Like, that must have been a, you know, a very tough invite to get. They both must be pretty impressive, powerful people. And you're right. You're absolutely right. It is, and it was, and we did. We did get invited. So I'm just, you know, do with that what you will. But, you know, I wanted also to have, you know, some counterpoint on the podcast and have sort of just some healthy debate, hear a smart voice from the other side, because, you know, I try not to be overtly political with this pod. I think the current political climate is so divisive. And so, you know, there's so much tension that I try to keep this sort of like a safe escape, no matter what you believe in. But, you know, I don't think it's hard to guess where my politics lie. And I've been lucky to have on people on the podcast who I really respect and who I, you know, mostly agree with. People like David Plouffe, who was Obama's campaign manager. People like Dylan Lowy and Liz Allen, who I'm now lucky enough to call friends, who worked in Obama's administration. So I wanted to make sure that there was some balance here. And in an effort to do that, I felt very excited when Dave's publicist reached out to have him on the pod. And a quick disclaimer, you know, we held this podcast because Dave has a book coming out April 28th. And we actually recorded this in late February. So this is before Vice President Biden was decided to be the Democratic nominee for president. This was before sort of the throes of coronavirus. I mean, it was happening, but it wasn't at the forefront. There was no quarantine. There was sort of none of this happening. So if you're wondering why we don't talk about it, it was because it wasn't quite where it is today and how it ramped up over the weeks that followed when we chatted. So yeah, so I think that's it. All right, enjoy Dave Rubin. Dave Rubin, come on. I've been watching videos of you.
Uh-oh.
I've been, my buddy Simon, shout out Simon, big fan, huge.
Am I in any sort of trouble?
Not at all. Please, we're both at Bob Saget's wedding. I mean, what more do you need to know?
Yeah, you know, that's actually pretty crazy story. I was on tour with Jordan Peterson at the time, and we were in the middle of this. You know, Jordan became this just absolute cultural worldwide phenomenon, and we did about 120 stops in a calendar year. So, like, it was just crazy, about 20 countries. And then Bob's wedding was in maybe October or something like maybe November. And we were on tour in Europe, and I was in England, and I had like a 2-day break, and then we were going to Amsterdam, and we got the invite for the wedding. And I was like, I gotta go to this wedding because I love Bob. I love Kelly.
You know, it's gonna be some nice high profile people there. People watching.
Josh Peck, Billy Crystal, you know, it's quite
John Mayer.
John Mayer.
Performed. That
John Mayer freaking performed. I mean, the wedding was unbelievable. And I really do love those guys. But more than anything else, I realized I'm in the middle of this tour, which was awesome and life changing and, you know, just meeting thousands of people from all over the world and blah, blah, blah. But so I flew home for one day. I flew from London. And then the wedding was in Santa Monica.
So
I did fly business.
Come on, you got
it. Yeah, thank God it was business. Otherwise, this may have been really pushing it. But yeah. I flew from London to LA, got home that morning, went to the wedding that night, and then the next morning, Sunday morning, flew back to Amsterdam.
Jeez.
And it was insane, but I was just like, if I don't do this, like, what is the point of anything that any of us do? Like, if you're going to miss your friends' weddings and all that kind of stuff. So it was a crazy thing. And Kelly gave me a shout out during the wedding. She's like, Dave Rubin even flew here for a day. So I was like, all right, this is pretty cool.
It's nice to
anyway,
be acknowledged.
Anyway, life is weird. That's the moral of the story, I guess.
It's nice to be acknowledged at a wedding, especially a famous people wedding. I mean, God, I remember when John Mayer got up
And he said something so great, which I imagine is his life. He said, I offered to play at the wedding because I assume that whenever I'm invited to a wedding, everyone wants me to play.
Yeah.
But they don't want, I mean, if you, when you got married, would you have asked John Mayer?
No, you want to give your friends like that little moment off to just be regular people, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But when they, if they offer it up, we're not saying no.
No. And you could feel it in that room. Like everybody's like, Mayer's got to do something. And he was just incredible. The guy is really, I don't know him well. I mean, I just met him that night and I think maybe one other time. But when you see these people that like a real artist, like there's so few people that are actually real artists, really trying to say something with what they do. And he so is. So to be at a wedding and in front of, you know, whatever it was, 150 people to do something that intimate, it was just so awesome.
It was so funny because, you know, I did a show with Stamos, which is how I know Bob. And, you know, Stamos and Dave Coulier and Bob, they're like truly brothers, you know? And so Mayer gets up and he's doing this little toast about Bob. And he's like, you know, think of Bob as a blues man. And Mayer just, and Stamos just looks at me and Dave and goes, blues man? Like, think of Bob a lot of ways, maybe not a blues man.
You know, it's funny for me. It's like you, because you as a child actor, like you grew up sort of around these people and, you know, obviously it presents all its own weirdness and all that. But for most people that aren't around these people and then you suddenly are, it's like you're seeing all of these people and it's like you almost can't believe that they're people.
Yeah.
Like when Bob introduced me to Stamos, there's something about Stamos. Maybe it's just the hair and just the way the guy carries himself. But you're like, this almost isn't like talking to a human. It's like talking to some other creature or something like that.
Yeah.
Or then Billy Crystal's there and then like we're like slow dancing and like my butt kind of hit Billy Crystal's butt and I was like, that was amazing.
No, that's the way you want to meet Billy Crystal.
That is the way you want to meet Billy
Crystal. Butt to butt.
Yeah.
So, you know, here we are. You got a new book.
Yeah.
You are having, I mean, I don't want to say you're having a moment because you've been having a moment. I mean, the ascent to have watched over the past few years, it's been pretty meteoric, right?
Well, I guess that's not really for me to say. But first, I should tell you this, that this is technically, I know you're going to hold this interview for a little bit.
Mm.
This is literally the first interview I'm doing relative to the book. Related to the book in any way. Yeah. Today is number one. I don't know if that it'll shake out related to when you drop it or that kind of stuff. But this is the first time that I'm publicly talking about the book at all. So there you go.
It can only go up from here.
It can only go up from here. Well, that's why we wanted to start it this way. You know
Kevin
what I mean?
Can echo. This is a middling podcast. Yeah. Kevin, actually, this is last day.
Last day, Kevin.
In full transparency.
Are you just announcing that now because of the book?
You're fired, Kevin.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
No, Kevin's going on to greener pastures and it's breaking my heart. I know.
That's tough when you build a team and then, you know, people have their own dreams, their own aspirations. And
assholes.
It's weird. And it's like, come
selfish.
On. I thought you were an indentured servant, man. You know?
I know. Kevin fully, you know, he's heard over almost 100 podcasts of mine, knows I never met my dad, knows I've got all that fun, you know, fucked up blueprint coding in my past. And here you are abandoning me further, you know, solidifying find my belief that no one will stick around.
Just to go do what you want to do in life. Okay. It's so weird how people do that.
You know, fun little transition. Speaking of people doing what they want to do in life, that's kind of your thing.
Yeah.
It's well,
that was a hell of a transition
Thank you.
I can see he has done 100 episodes. That was incredible. Yeah, well, it's interesting because all I really started to do, I think what put me on the map in these last, let's say 5 years or so, is that I just started to say what I was thinking more. Mm. Really, that's it. Like I saw something about 5-6 years ago where people were suddenly afraid to say what they think, which now has become very mainstream, you know, with this idea of cancel culture. And the second you tweet out one opinion that, you know, not everybody likes, you just get crushed or, you know, it's not just public people. I mean, that's what I'm more fascinated by actually, that right now, good, decent people, regular people with regular jobs and families that are just going on living their life are afraid to say what they think. And not because they're racist or bigots or bad people or anything like that. They're just afraid to say anything that falls outside of what mainstream is willing to accept. And they think if they tweet out one thing, that next thing you know, you're going to show up to your office and HR is going to go, oh, you know, you said you supported Trump, or you implied you supported Trump, or you said there's two genders, or you said you're for low taxes or states' rights or some weird thing. And next thing you know, you're in a lot of trouble. And I started talking about that. And then really I started talking about identity politics, which I think is the most dangerous force, I think, across the Western world right now, that we walk around thinking that because you're white, that you should have this set of views, or because you're straight, you should have this set of views, or that because you're black or Muslim or Jewish or gay or whatever else, that somehow those immutable characteristics define you more than what's actually going on in your brain and how you behave and what you think and all of those things. I think that's so deeply dangerous. It's the reverse of everything that America is founded upon, and what it's really the reverse of what humans are supposed to do, right? Like, it's your job in this world, I think, to figure out what you think, why you think it, and then live a life that gives you some validation, that gives you some sense of purpose and drive and all of those things. And in many ways, identity politics is just sucking that away from the average person. So I started talking about these things, and then the general crush on free speech related to big tech and the rest of it. And then I guess I was a little ahead of the curve, because now a lot of the things that I was saying 5 years ago suddenly are popping up into mainstream. So it's a little weird sometimes when you're ahead on certain things. My friend Andrew, who I used to do some comedy writing with, would always say to me, Dave, we're so ahead of the curve, we're behind it. Right. And sometimes I feel that way, because now I see a lot of people will just be repeating things that I said 5 years ago, which is great, because it's like, oh, I said something that was real that now has sort of trickled up or whatever. And then on the other hand, it's like, man, if just more people had been paying attention, maybe we wouldn't be in this weird spot. But I'll take it.
It's fashion, right? Like, all the best designers are getting ready for fall 2021.
Yeah.
Like today.
It's the same thing. It is the same thing.
You're projecting actually what's going to be popular in 18 months to 2 years.
Yeah. And it's weird. And I think about it sometimes. It's like, what makes some people be able to see things ahead a little bit? Because all of this stuff that we're seeing now, everything that we're seeing politically right now, I don't know where you fall politically, and wherever you fall, even if we disagreed with literally everything, it wouldn't matter to me. From what I know about you, you're a good guy, and I love like getting into the differences of opinion and all that stuff. But I think what we've seen, where the left has just gone so crazy, the people that used to be for free expression and for freedom of speech and for liberalism, letting people live the way they want to, have now become sort of like the crazed, screeching people that they always used to mock, you know? And that's not even a defense of really what's happening on the right, which is a whole other thing. But I come from the left. I think most young people, I'm 43. How old are you? 33, right? So is that, are you Gen X or are you a millennial?
I'm a millennial.
Or you're
I'm a millennial,
Gen Y-er.
You're X.
Yeah, I'm X. I am firmly X.
I'm millennial. And then it's Gen Z or the
Gen
teens?
Z. And that, well, now there's the—
And the 20-year-olds?
Well, then, yeah, so the millennials. And then I guess there's the Zoomers that are like—
What the fuck?
The Zoomers are like—
That's a PBS show I grew up with.
Is that right? Right. The Zoomers are like the 12-year-olds that are on TikTok that—
Yikes.
—are now like completely anti-establishment. Like, if you go on TikTok, they all love Trump because it's like cool. It's because it's so crazy the other way. You know what I mean? They've sort of taken the pendulum and gone the other way.
One of the most fascinating moments in 2016 was I had gone to a Hillary Clinton fundraiser, and I had this photo of me and her and Wilmer Valderrama.
Ah, yes.
Just saying.
From 70s Show.
Quite— Yeah. —the meeting of the minds.
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, I'm not overtly political, even on this podcast. I don't think it's like, I don't think you have to, you know, move far to know where my politics lie. But again, like, I never want to polarize my audience—
Sure.
—or alienate anyone. But on election day, I posted the photo of Wilmer, Hillary, and I posted, I said something to the effect of, right or left, I think we can all agree that Wilmer Valderrama is a very handsome man. And, you know, my followers are, I mean, if you looked at my insights right now, it would be 18 to 24 in the majority, 65% female, but it's all living in that sort of 16 to 30 years old.
Yeah.
And before this, like many, you know, liberal Democrats, my thoughts were that the screams of Republicans were that of dinosaurs,
mm-hmm.
you know, of just like an older specific type.
I hear you.
And what was revealed in the comment section of over 3,000 comments were all my followers, 80 to 85% saying lock her up.
Yeah.
And I remember in that moment thinking, uh-oh, we're in trouble.
Yeah. And that actually is why I wasn't that surprised by the election. I was on Joe Rogan's podcast either the day of the election or the day before of the 2016 election. And he was asking me, like, what do you think? And I was like, oh, it's 50-50. And I think Trump definitely could win, because I had had a bunch of people on my show, from Scott Adams to Mike Cernovich to even Milo. And forgetting what you think about any of these people specifically, or even if you know them, I had just heard people that I thought were thoughtful talking about why they thought Trump was going to win, or what at least the energy was behind Trump. So none of it shocked me. And the reason it shocked all the mainstream people was because, well, none of you guys were listening. You know what I mean? Like, there was clearly something happening online. And it's like, we come from the online generation, right? So I'm at the older end of it, but I was born out of this thing, and I've been doing a YouTube thing forever. Mm. So I wasn't shocked, because I don't just watch mainstream media. But it's interesting, because everybody was kind of thrown up in the air during that election. When I was driving, so I used to live in West Hollywood. I've since moved, but my polling place for that election was in West Hollywood. So I had about a 20-minute drive to get there. And we're driving there, and David, my husband, I live this, right? Like, I live politics, right? I tell people what I think all the time. And we're driving there, and I'm going, I don't know what I'm going to do. Because I really didn't want to vote for Hillary. I thought Trump was nuts. But I thought Hillary was just deeply corrupt and would have just, like, tightened the screws on everything that I thought was wrong. And I was like, is Trump really the answer? I really did not know what to do. We get online in West Hollywood, and then this is, like, the most, like, LA thing that could possibly happen. I'm standing online, and who am I behind at the West Hollywood polling station? RuPaul.
Great.
So now I'm behind.
Surprisingly tall.
Extremely tall.
6'6"?
Extremely tall. Not in drag, obviously, just as regular.
Just a handsome man.
Just a fine-looking, very tall, thin man, but it's RuPaul. And I go into the polling station, the station, whatever you want to call it, and I did not know what to do. And at the last second, I thought, you know what? I'm in California, and unfortunately, because of the nature of the demographics here, it's not going to really matter what I do. So I did the one thing that I thought I could live with, which was I voted for the libertarian Gary Johnson, who I had on the show, and I would love to smoke a joint with the guy and go skiing with him, but he was a terrible candidate, just like couldn't even explain any basic thought that had anything to do with libertarianism, and he was just awful. But I was like, you know what, I can at least live with myself on that one.
But that's a vote for Trump, right?
Well, in California, it just doesn't matter. But in essence, I just didn't want, I had to do something that I felt I could live with. And at the time, I couldn't live with either one. This time I will vote for one of the two main ones. I won't pull the third party thing this time.
You're so right, because it was revealed to me, as I said in the comment section, that there was like this very active, young, you know, Trump support that I, as a liberal Democrat up until that point, had been living, you know, in a bit of a fog, and I was not seeing that. And yet, and it's funny because next week I have my friend Dylan Lowy, who was Joe Biden's speechwriter for many years and worked in the Obama administration, a brilliant guy. And we talked to something to this effect, and he said, you know, was it like, if 50,000 people had voted differently in Wisconsin and Michigan and a couple other, like, yes, there's this movement, but also, like, it wasn't that far off from Hillary winning the electoral votes. And because she won 3 million more in the popular, that we would have said, listen, it was a close race, but this is definitive and this is the direction our
country's
going.
Right, but the thing is, even if that's true, and that technically that may be right, like you move 50,000 votes here and we know that, you know, these little states that he just snuck by the electoral college would have been different.
And the people
but even but even that still, it would have shown that there would have been a massive movement happening, even if he would have lost, because if everyone's running around, and this is what I kept saying, you're running around, you guys are calling him Hitler, you're calling his supporters Nazis. I mean, first off, it's the most disgusting. I mean, these are the same people that are obsessed with cultural appropriation. I mean, it's the worst sort of cultural appropriation that you could actually ever do, to be throwing Nazi and Hitler around constantly, because you degrade those words to the point that they've become meaningless, which now they have become meaningless, actually. But the point is that it would have shown that, let me get this straight. The mainstream media says this guy is pure evil, and he still almost won. You know what I mean? Even if he had just lost, it still would have sort of led us here. What I'm more fascinated by is that the day after the election, I did a, we were building my home studio at the time. So I just did a little video with my phone. And I said, look, guys, I understand everyone's crazed right now. And especially if you're a lefty or you're a liberal or you're just like a mainstream kind of apolitical person, you're kind of freaked out because Donald Trump's the president. So something weird is going on here, right? I said, but the thing is, you got to give him a little time here, because if he doesn't turn out to be Hitler, if we don't get into extra wars, if the economy doesn't crash, if things basically work, well, you've painted, it's not what you've done to Trump by saying all these bad things. It's what you've done to yourself, because you've painted yourself into a corner, because now you can't 3 years later, and this is sort of where we're at right now, things are basically pretty good. We're not getting into other wars. The economy's a little weird right now because of Corona, but the economy's been pretty good. Things are basically going fine. And it's like, you can't suddenly be like, oh yeah, the guy I've been calling Hitler and all of his Nazi supporters, he's okay. They're pretty good. So it's like you're painting yourself into a corner. It's not what you do to him. And I think that's why we see these people constantly, they constantly up the ante all the time. So it's always, remember we killed Soleimani, the Iranian general, for a week on Twitter, it's World War III. Now it's gone. That was 2 months ago. Remember, we were having World War III 2 months ago. Mm. Or net neutrality. Remember net neutrality? And now the internet's going to be destroyed forever. Internet still seems to be here. You know, like this one's a little ahead of you, but Y2K. Remember Y2K? And sure. The whole, every planes were going to be falling out of the sky and blah, blah, blah. And they ramp everything up to the point that then somehow you just forget about it. And then 3 days later, there's something new. And that's why right now, even though I know you're holding this for a little bit with Corona, it's a little bit like, how can you gauge what is actually real? It's like, for me, it's like, I don't really trust the mainstream media anymore. They pushed Russia hoax forever. Like, they've blown their credibility. So it's like, I'm starting to trust online people more, but they have their own. And I say this with myself too, like if you're just going for clickbait, that's a problem. Or if you're just going for eyeballs or downloads or whatever. So it's a weird place to be a thinking person in 2020. It's on you to try to figure out who you can trust, because mainstream ain't going to do it for you. And you could end up down a real crazy rabbit hole if you just follow everybody online. So there's a lot there.
Well, we're also dealing with like, and this is maybe where I give a little bit of, I allow for a little bit of fuckery amongst or hysteria.
Yeah.
Because like we're dealing with like this social media pipeline is unlike anything we've ever experienced fucking ever. Yep. Right. And when we talk about any sort of like, you know, when it came up in the last couple of weeks about, you know, Facebook allowing political ads that were, I mean, you know, basically some of which were just untruthful and taking money for it. It was like, well, yes, you can use the First Amendment, of course, but A, it's a private business, and B, like, we don't know, like we're at least exploring this because we've never had a 2.5 billion person pipeline, right? Where something can be delivered and that there will be some people who will not be able to discern the fact that like this is being targeted for me in a very specific way and perhaps could be untrue.
So are you for Facebook figuring out what is true and then deciding what they can put on there or not?
Here's my thoughts about it. A, it's a private company, right?
Yep.
So I don't necessarily feel as though it has to fall under the First Amendment.
Yeah. Although they do tread the line of what a private company is, because they have so many big government contracts, and we know there's backdoors into what they're doing and all that kind of stuff. But I basically agree with the premise. Yes, they're, for the way we can describe it now, yeah, they're a private company.
What I would say is it's like anything, right? Is that if any of the major, you know, distributors of content, be it a radio station, a TV station, whatever, if we found something that they were delivering us to be intentionally untrue and they were making profit from it, it would behoove us to rise up and say, fuck this.
Yep.
You know, they're selling us lies and this is unacceptable. I think we're spoiled because many of these companies have a bit of a checks and balances in place, and the legality of it leaves them to say, maybe it doesn't serve us, even though this is a nice check, because we're going to get sued up the ass if we do put this out. But yeah, I think it would behoove Facebook to follow suit of what people in their position in a smaller way have done historically.
Yeah, I think that answer is basically the right one. I mean, let's go on the assumption they're a private company, at least for the purposes of this. I mean, they are. And again, they have some weird things with the government, and they, you know, they drag out Zuckerberg. Can you imagine being worth however billions, gajillions of dollars that he's worth. And every few months he has to sit in front of AOC and all of these ridiculous Congress people and ask questions. And none of them know what the hell they're talking about. And he has to answer their questions. But putting that aside, the idea that Facebook or some sort of big entity should be basically telling us what is true is so deeply dangerous. And it's not a game that they want to play, because so if you were to say, if Donald Trump was to put out an ad that said there are two genders, there's male and female, those are the two biological genders. That's not anti-trans, actually. It's just there are biological genders. And then if you identify as a trans person and want to transition, you're not, the simple truth is you're not changing your biology. The trans activists won't let you say that. And then we get caught in this stuff about pronouns and all that. But would it be true or false? If you were leaving it to Facebook to decide whether it's true or false. Mm. So I saw Andrew Yang, who I've had on the show, who I like. I think he brought some new ideas to the table. He was sort of a centrist, a little too big government maybe for me, but like clearly a good human. And he was tweeting about how Facebook should be, deciding what is true or not when they do these ads. And I wrote back to him on Twitter and I said, well, how many genders are there? And he didn't respond, but I think he probably got what my point is that I think ultimately your answer is right, which is it's on us these days. And that's what I meant before. When it's on thinking people to have to decipher what the truth is through the noise right now. That is very different than at one time when we could sort of trust the news. But Walter Cronkite's long gone. You know what I mean? Like the mainstream media has just left, and we're looking at institutions that a lot of us think still exist in functional ways, and they've just been like rotted out from the inside. So I wouldn't want to trust Facebook to tell me what is true. And by the way, when the government tells Facebook, oh, you're going to have to do it, you know, that's the government. The government knows, because of the First Amendment, that they can't tell us what we can say. So when they tell a company to do it, that's even more dangerous, because then they're applying pressures that really they don't have to then step on the First Amendment. So there's so much stuff there.
But we have like these institutions in place, like even on a smaller level, like the Better Business Bureau, right? Yeah. Protections in place for us, yeah, the consumers, so that we're not like actively fucked with. And so I would imagine so that it would serve us perhaps to say, like, again, we've never dealt with an information stream this broad, right? Yeah. And I'm sure you know, we both have older Jewish relatives.
Yeah, I got a lot of old Jewish relatives.
That, you know, like my mom will see shit on Facebook and I'll be like, and she'll call me in a tizzy and I'll be like, read the source.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
This is important for you. So like, to a certain extent, we do entrust certain watchdogs or...
Right, but what you're telling her to do is read the source, and that's right. And then, and even that's not perfect too, because something could be good for a while. You know, I see a lot in like online magazines or places, you know, where articles are put up that are good for like a year, and then they start getting high on it, and so they want more clicks, and then they suddenly go down really quick. I've seen a whole bunch of those over the last couple of years. So it's really tough, but I think your gut instinct is still the right one, which is you have to figure it out. Like through the madness, you got to try to find a couple voices that you think are decent, and they might fail you at times. And then maybe you move on, maybe you don't, maybe they explain themselves. But what I think is true now is that young people especially, nobody cares. Like when I was growing up and when I first started doing stand-up, I wanted to host The Tonight Show, right? Like everybody wanted to host The Tonight Show.
Sure.
That's what you wanted to do.
Yeah,
David Letterman wanted the Johnny Carson Tonight Show. The idea of hosting The Tonight Show now is like ludicrous to me. Like first off, why would anyone want it? Young people don't care about it anymore. You know, nobody cares what's on at 11:30. Now anyone that watches it is watching it to fall asleep. But the point is that these institute, like it was an institution forever, but nothing lasts forever, right? So it's like Colbert then takes over for Letterman. Letterman was pretty apolitical, but kind of subversive. Colbert is a total lefty. Like it's gone completely in that route. You may like that route, you may not. But the institution of The Tonight Show, it just isn't anymore. It's an idea that we think is still kind of something. And I guess if I get the call from The Tonight Show while I'm on the book tour, I guess I'll do it. although it would seem ridiculous to me. Like, it would actually seem ridiculous.
But you're doing it.
No, but I would do it, right? I'm not going to be like, no, I'm not doing it, right? And my book people want me to sell some books.
It would be bigger if you went on Joe Rogan.
It would be way bigger to go on Joe Rogan. It would be way bigger for other people to do my show, to do your show. Like, this is the new way people are getting these things. And it's not because we're backed by institutions. Like, look at this room that we're sitting in, right? We're in a cool sound booth, but it's pretty small. There's no cameras. It's the two of us and your producer, and he's getting the hell out of here by the time we finish this thing.
Please, he's already putting his shoes on.
He can walk out in the middle of this. But this ability to communicate with people and no commercial breaks, and that I might trip over something I say here, or you might reveal something accidentally you didn't mean to, that is real. That's what people crave versus, 6:30, ABC, NBC, CBS, all kind of saying the same thing. They slightly reorder it. And a certain amount of people just watch it because they always have. And I'm not saying all these people are bad. I'm not saying all the institutions are bad. But there is a reason they're all crumbling. And it is mostly their fault. It is just this morning I saw Chris Hayes on MSNBC. He tweeted out that if you call it the Wuhan virus, that's racist. Now, first off, there are articles where MSNBC, his employer, is calling it Wuhan just from a few weeks ago. CNN's been calling it Wuhan. I mean, plenty of people have. Wuhan is not a race also. It's a city in China.
Sure.
And even if they called it the China outbreak or whatever, the China virus, that wouldn't be racist. That it's a nationality, not a race. That's also, but putting that aside. But this rush to make everything about race and to keep us just like angry at each other all the time, it's infecting all of the institutions. It's infecting colleges. I mean, Harvard now, they put these policies in place that if you're Asian, they want less Asian students. So they actually have policies that make it harder to be an Asian student. Why should we be punishing people based on the color of their skin or their ethnicity or their religion? I thought that's that MLK guy. Remember that guy? He was totally against that. But for some reason, now we think it's okay. But ultimately, what they'll do is they'll end up bringing in less qualified people. The Asian students who work very hard, who were never given anything. It's not like Asians came here from Korea or Japan or China and somehow were given some special package. They worked really hard. They studied. They care about education and family, and they've succeeded. Why would we punish people because of that? But that's how all of this is. That's why all of this is related.
I do want to talk about that, but before we leave the Facebook thing,
yeah.
I want to ask you, like, we do have these institutions in place, right, where there is a certain level of trust, and Malcolm Gladwell has talked a lot mm-hmm. about this with his new book, where, like, anyone who says they're good at spotting or catching a liar is fucking lying. We're terrible at it.
Yeah.
As the human race, we're awful at it. Like, we believe 95% of things we hear on a daily basis at all times, because we have to.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would literally be like, our rudimentary animal selves, where everything is a threat at all times, right? So assuming that's true, mm-hmm. that, like, living in this world where any piece of information that comes in has to be, like, properly vetted seems exhausting and not quite.
But I don't know what the better option is. I don't know what the better option is. I don't like central planning. I don't like the idea. I like bottom up. Like, so this is where I would say, so politically, I describe myself as a classical liberal, which I would be happy to get into. I would say it's a libertarian with maybe a little more of just a realistic streak, because if you go too far down the libertarian thing, you have no government, you end up in Mad Max. And I think there's an interesting
full Ayn Rand.
Yeah. And I think that, by the way, I think there's a really interesting intellectual exercise there. I think it's actually pretty intellectually clean and makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. I just don't think it's the most realistic thing. And I would also say that classical liberalism, basically individual freedom, individual rights and human freedom with just enough government guardrails, is exactly what the founders wanted. I think that's why America still, after 200 plus years, is the greatest, freest country that more people want to come to and nobody wants to leave, right? Lena Dunham's still here. These people don't leave. They never leave. Alyssa Milano's still here. Like, they're all here. They never go. But where the hell was I going with that? There was a point in there somewhere. Oh, man.
You'll get it.
Yeah. Because you looked at me when I said Alyssa Milano, and I'm wondering if you guys are suddenly friends. That popped in my head.
First of all, I've always wished I was friends with Alyssa Milano, but not necessarily for her politics.
No, because your eye kind of lit up when I said that.
No.
And then I thought, he's friends with Alyssa Milano, and then I lost my train of thought.
I was thinking about the Joe Rogan joke where he said something to the effect of, like, if the forefathers saw us 200 years, you know, after, and you didn't change shit.
Right.
We wrote it with a feather.
Yeah. You know what? It is a good joke, and I saw it.
Sure.
But I actually, the premise, I think, is actually wrong. Because it's not that first off, we did change it. We've added amendments and things over the course of years. So we've expanded people's voting rights and all sorts of freedoms, right? We always expand freedoms. We've never taken away freedoms, with the most crazy few exemptions to that, like, you know, Japanese internment and things like that, which was a temporary thing. It was a horrible thing, but it was a temporary thing. We always expand more freedom so Black people can vote and women can vote and gay marriage and things like that. Anyway, now I remember where I was going, which is, that I believe in bottom up, meaning that I want you to live whatever life you want to live, as long as you're not infringing on my freedoms. And that's how I believe that everyone should live. And then we start with everything local. That's why states' rights are important. That's why you should care more about who your local congressman is, which I would bet something like 80%, if not more, Americans have no idea who their local congressman is.
Ted Lieu.
Yeah, there you go.
God bless him.
You're in lucky.
Teddy Lieu.
Yeah, Ted and I don't
West
get along
LA.
Very well.
I would imagine.
Yeah. But you should care about Ted Lieu in your district, right? And I won't name my congressman because I don't want people to know exactly where I live.
Sure.
But the point is that I believe that if you start from the bottom, you can build something up. I don't like central planning coming down below. And that's what the founders feared the most. We left a king who basically could do everything, make every decision for people. And this is the way, by the way, that I would want the internet to be, that we would have as much autonomy as possible. And I just don't trust that Facebook will do the right thing just because they have a board of diversity, or Google at one time, what was their policy? Do no evil, or we are good.
Still, do no evil.
All of those things, well, do no evil. What is it? It's meaningless. It sounds good. But I think we're fed these days, like, just a lot of platitudes that all kind of sound right. We're for diversity. We're for all these things. We're for women. For women, it doesn't mean anything. Yes, everyone wants women to be equal and treated decently. You know, I guess there's a sliver of people that don't want that, but, like, you're for women. Well, you know, this is something you hear from, like, lefties a lot. I'm for women. Well, are you for Nikki Haley? Are you for Sarah Huckabee Sanders or Meghan McCain or Candace Owens? You're for women that behave the way you want them to. You actually hate women who you disagree with. So there's just, like, a plethora of just, like, big slogans that we're hit with all the time. And that's why I would prefer that everyone just kind of stay out of everybody's life. And then we need some laws. We need some laws to make sure the states aren't warring with each other and make sure, you know, property rights and things like that. But beyond that, I really think that's how most people want to live. I think that's how most people actually do live, with the exception of how we all behave on Twitter or something like that.
This is something I'm fascinated about, and I don't know if you listen to him or maybe he's too far from your politics, but, like, I love Scott Galloway.
I don't know him, actually.
He does a podcast with Kara Swisher called Pivot.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah,
he wrote
yeah.
The Algebra of Happiness. He's a really, really smart. He's a professor at NYU, and he talks about how you look at someone like Bezos, right, who benefited from our tax law in building his company, right?
Yeah.
And then he builds this unbelievable company and becomes the richest man in the world, and then has all his money in stock and never cashes in that stock, so he doesn't have to pay capital gains tax, and takes $1 billion line of credit from JP Morgan so that he doesn't have to, and then he can write off the interest on that just so he doesn't have to cash in his stock.
Yep.
And basically, and then Amazon doesn't pay taxes. Now, obviously, the prosperity that they've introduced into the workforce and into America is massive. That goes without saying.
Yeah. By the way, Amazon is paying taxes throughout the year. They're talking about income tax, but Amazon is paying payroll taxes and all sorts of other things.
Sure.
And the employees that Amazon creates all pay taxes too. But I get what they're saying. At the end of the year, Amazon's not writing a big check to the government. Yeah.
But, you know, what Galloway says to a certain extent, it's like he benefited from these laws. Like, he benefited from these laws that were in place to allow him to prosper. And then when he, you know, got over a certain tipping point, there was a lack of paying it forward. And I think, like, it's not illegal, right? It's not illegal that Donald Trump didn't pay a certain amount of income tax.
That's the screwed up system. You can't, you know.
They game the system.
Don't hate the player.
Beautifully.
Yeah.
But like, then the government goes, well done.
Yeah.
You got us, right? Because we're the government and we're always going to be behind. But like, now we're going to evolve and like change it up a little. And everyone goes, oh, you're moving the line.
Yeah.
And they're like, you fucked us.
Right.
Like, you gamed us good. And now we're going to change the lines. And guess what? You'll game us again in 10 years.
Well, they will game them again. And again, to me, I don't consider that really an argument for government. It's an argument for the inefficiency of government, that government is always behind. You can only create a set of rules, right? So you create a set of rules. And then what a good player of a game. I mean, think about a video game. Like, you learn how to play a game or a board game, anything, and you'll figure out the best way around it. So yes, I agree. Like, could there be a better system so that Jeff Bezos doesn't have to have all that money? I'm not sure ethically that even makes sense, because the amount of goodness and worth and jobs and economic prosperity that this guy has created is unimaginable. And my brother-in-law has a small salmon jerky company up in Tacoma, Washington. And they use the Amazon marketplace. So they create this, wild caught sustainable salmon jerky. It's actually quite good. It's called Wild Merman Salmon Jerky. They create it. And then they are able to sell it using the marketplace that Amazon has created. So people will always come into Amazon's crushing small businesses. Actually, there's thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of, if not millions, I have no idea, of small businesses that use the marketplace that Amazon created. So then Amazon, pays their employees pretty well. You get all your stuff, right? I mean, every day boxes keep showing up to my house. My studio's in my house. There's always some wire we need or some drive we need or something. Things seem to show up there within a couple hours. This morning, it was salmon again, but I got salmon delivered to my door, fresh salmon from Whole Foods that's now owned by Amazon. So I'm not defending every little piece of all the ways they can get away all these things and capital gains. And I'm not an economist and all that. But I would say, broadly speaking, I would just want people to get out of the way. You earn something, whatever you earn, Josh Peck, I want you to keep more of it. Like, you should keep more of it. I think you have a much better understanding of how to live your life and keep the money that you work hard for than anyone else. And then if you want to donate more to homelessness, let's say, right? LA, we're in Hollywood right now. I mean, it's becoming a real shithole out there. I mean, the homeless situation is out of control. I was just up in San Francisco. I saw people shooting up on the street. I mean, California, we're watching the results of progressive policies that always say, oh, we're going to help poor people and all this, except that's where always the worst homelessness is, always.
Well, and it's in major cities because that's where people are.
It's not in Salt Lake City. It's not in Dallas. It's not in the more
comparable. Are these cities comparable to somewhere like New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco?
Well, I lived in New York City most of my life. New York City didn't have it under Giuliani. It had it under Dinkins before him, a progressive, and then Giuliani cleaned it up. And now we have de Blasio, and Bloomberg basically kept it under control. And now, I don't know the last time you were in New York City, but it's exploding again because we have another progressive in Bloomberg. And you're not, you can jump the turnstile and we won't arrest you. It's like, or arrest you or fine you or whatever. And it's like, all these policies, they kind of sound right. We kind of want to help poor people more, and you should be able to jump a turnstile if you don't have the money. It sort of sounds right. But then you're just incentivizing bad behavior, and then you get more and more and more and more of this. So anyway, back to Amazon, though. I just think they've created something with unimaginable wealth. And like, does anyone need as much money as Bezos has? And he probably has several islands and helicopters and yachts and all those things. No, but think about the amount of people that he just employs in his life,
but
you know,
and
all of those things.
If there's no government, what stops him?
Well, I don't say no governments. This is why I would say I'm a classical liberal and not a libertarian, because I don't think you can or should deconstruct all of that. I think you want a slim, trim government. So when the Democrats, Bernie, I need $780 billion for Medicare for all, and they just make up numbers, right? Bernie's never built anything. He's never employed, right, anybody. I'm a small business. I've employed some people. So I have more qualifications to run something than Bernie Sanders does. He's good at complaining about things, right? Like, there's nothing like an old Jew complaining about things. He's like your uncle that's never done anything, that just knows how to run the world, banging his fists at the Passover table or something. Like, that's all he's ever all he's ever done.
But that's not rare in politics necessarily, right? Like we
that's why politics sucks, because we should have people that get things done. So Trump, love him, hate him, whatever it is, Trump is an executive. Now you could say, well, Trump steak failed and Trump water went nowhere and blah, blah, blah.
Kind of everything.
Yeah, but he also built a lot of things and then he writes off losses and takes advantage of all of those things. But I think most people would say Trump is willing to make decisions, right? Like he makes decisions. And that's what the executive branch, right? The president is in charge of the executive branch. That's what he's supposed to do.
But you and I growing up in New York know a lot of fucking people that are quick with responses. They're not always the best.
No, they're definitely not
like,
the best.
That's for me, sometimes my a little bit of what irks me about the Trump of it all with the people that voted for him, because people are so fucking impressed with themselves that they saw their image in Trump.
Yeah.
They were like, he talks like me and I'd be a good fucking president. The difference is I don't want my president to be like me.
Yeah.
Like I want my president to be measured, because I am the guy that's going to explode in road rage and be impulsive and like have moments and write the wrong tweet at times. I actually want my president to be a little bit more measured and thoughtful.
Yeah. But you know, the thing is, so I agree with you, right? Like if Thomas Jefferson was alive, I would probably vote for Thomas Jefferson. You know what I mean? Who was writing incredible essays that were freeing the slaves, who, by the way, at the same time, he owned slaves and was having relations with at least one, which in modern day would be considered rape. Mm. So, you know, they'll come for Thomas Jefferson one day, which they've tried already, or they'll come for everyone on Mount Rushmore, or they'll come, by the way, for Barack Obama, who the first time he ran for president, he was against gay marriage. So, you know, they're building the Obama Library in Chicago right now. And it's like the progressives of 2040, when they find out that Barack Obama, the president in 2013, was against gay marriage, they're going to want to tear down his library too. So yes, would I like a president that everyone liked Obama, right? Like he looked good. He spoke well. It seemed like he was banging his wife. Like all of it seemed very nice, but he lied in a lot of, you know, Syria red line. And if you like your health care, you can keep it. But he lied the way we like them to lie. Like it was, he lied through like, oh, you're a politician and you just lie about stuff. Trump lies every day, constantly. I have no doubt about that. He lies in a different way. But what I think about Trump sort of is that he's just doing the dirty work that all the liberals need him to do. Because Trump's not a far-right maniac. Trump's keeping the wheels on America. Like, Trump loves this country. Look how good it's been for his family. And I actually think that one of the biggest problems that Democrats are going to have come election time, and it's a little bit softer now because now that it looks like it won't be Bernie. But had it been Bernie, it would have been like this guy who I think actually dislikes America. He likes Denmark and Sweden. He likes these places that I don't even know if he's ever been to that are tiny countries that are deeply different than America. And Trump would have just had to gone up there and been like, I love America. And Bernie would have been basically screaming how much he hates America. Like they can't, if you watch these debates, they can't say anything good about America. If it's Biden, putting aside the cognitive issues, which seem to be getting worse and worse, Biden, I think, at least loves America. And he occasionally talks about the Constitution and freedom and things like that. So it'll be a little bit better. But in a weird way, I think Trump wanted Bernie, because then it's like, yeah, it's me or the socialist. Let's do it.
But don't you think Biden, especially his surge over the last week and a half, speaks to the realities of like, and your sort of your take on things, and it's become more and more popular about, and your views on the left and the progressives, when the reality is,
yes, I'm having a bit of a nice moment here because people are starting to agree with what I've been screaming about
a little bit. I will say, like, I was listening to you at I think you were interviewed at Liberty University. Mm-hmm. And like you talk about that, you qualify that with the Prager You guys. Is there a part of you that feels a little bit like Russia in World War II in the respect of they're like, let's just use him now. We're on the same side. But as soon as this fucking thing is over, Cold War, he's our enemy again. It's got to be in the back of your head slightly.
I can't. I mean, totally honestly, there's not none of that that is in my head. I would say when this first started happening, so when I first started waking up and really seeing this identity politics thing with the left and seeing the creep of socialism and seeing and really understanding what is American versus the ideas that they're trying to import here. And then I started talking about it. I was absolutely shocked to find all of these people on the right that wanted to talk to me. Now, is there some level of, does it play well for them to have a gay person that agrees with them on some things? Is there a PR version of that that plays well just at that level? Well, of course there is. But the idea that that would define all of this, or that they, that somehow all of them, I mean, everyone that I meet, again, I traveled, you know, I'm about to go on tour again, but I traveled the country with Jordan Peterson, meeting all of these people, most of whom were conservatives, or I would say ex-lefties. It's ex-lefties that are now conservative, really. That they're all suddenly hiding their hatred of gays, really, so that because they have this one and he's going to slowly help them. I mean, that's like, you know, it would be the same thing like Candace Owens. You know, it's like if the right is supposed to hate black people, but they've embraced her, is there some PR version, some veneer version of this that it is optically good for them? But guess what? There are incredible people, economists like Thomas Sowell, who I've had on the show, who's 80 some odd years old, who happens to be a black man, who's a libertarian economist, who's been screaming about this forever. There's Larry Elder. There's my friend David Webb. I mean, these are just a few black conservatives that I could name. So I can't say that there's absolutely nothing to what you're saying. Is there some true, like, real Christian conservative out there that sees like a utility in using a gay person for now, and then we'll throw them under the bus eventually? I suppose that could exist. But to get to exactly where you started this, I went to Liberty University. I spoke in front of 14,000 evangelical Christians. Jerry Falwell Jr. up there, the dean of the school up there. These people were incredibly nice, incredibly gracious. Yeah, dude, when I walked around campus after, did a few people say they were going to pray for me? Yeah, I don't know if they actually meant my sexuality. I think they say this to a lot of people. They were like, oh, I love what you do. I'm going to pray for you, meaning my continued success. But maybe some of them meant it about my sexuality. But I would say either way. The other thing is about this, that it's almost like insulting to my own ability to think. To really go too far down that, like, maybe I'm using them, you know, like if you really want to play it that way, like maybe I'm using them to make them a little saner. I'm not. But by the way, I mean, in the book, I lay out these differences I have, like, to think about it. They know that I went up there, these evangelicals, forget gay marriage. They know that I'm pro-choice and they still invited me. Show me where that happens on the other side. It just doesn't happen on the other side. It doesn't. So it's a good question. It really is. And all I can do is consistently say what I think and hopefully find the right people along the ride that kind of dig it.
But do you feel that being Jewish and gay and believing the things that you do, it also weirdly, I don't want to say protects you, but like, is this interesting qualifier in the sense of if you were just another white Christian guy with these beliefs, it would seem as though you fell into the old guard.
There may be some version of that, but I would say that's a flip on identity politics, right? That is the right at some level using identity politics because it's using it against the people that are obsessed with identity politics. So like if Candace Owens was white, would she have the cultural effect that she is having, saying the exact same things? Probably not. But it's pretty powerful for a young black woman to get up there and say, I mean, literally the same thing that Kanye said, which is simply black people don't have to be Democrats. That's a pretty powerful thing to say. It's a ridiculous thing to have to say, but it shows you how out of whack our politics are. But by the way, right now, I mean, again, and I don't like using these immutable characteristics as a thing. Religion's slightly different because religion is mutable because you can convert or not believe in anything or whatever else. But on the Jewish front, I mean, the left is now stuck in what I would say is about 2 years behind what the UK just went through, where the worst sort of genuine anti-Semites, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, these people truly, their obsession with Israel, it's not... Oh, we like Jews, but we're just obsessed with this place that has half the world's Jews. That's the tiniest little sliver the size of New Jersey that without the West Bank is about 6 miles wide. And every single person that lives in the country is under the threat of a rocket hitting. And they've lived through stabbings and bus bombings and suicide, blah, blah, blah. And if only they would give up more land, everything would be okay. It's such nonsense.
I mean, they're what's voted the in. They didn't win in a coup, right? Isn't this echoing your feelings of like we're allowing them because they won an election to have their voice, and if we want them out, we'll vote them out?
Were you talking about Ilhan Omar and Tlaib? Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I hope that well, that's what I think could happen here. I've often said to many of my friends that still consider themselves on the left, so some of the lefties that I've had on many times, like Sam Harris and the Weinstein brothers and some of those guys, like it's clear I wouldn't say I've necessarily moved to the right. I've moved to the right economically, which we already hit on, but I would say most of my beliefs are pretty much the same. But I think once you start really seeing what freedom is, what real freedom is, I think the course will move you to the right. You know, there's that saying, if you're not a liberal in your 20s, you have no heart. And if you're not a conservative in your 30s, you have no brain. I don't think it's just like a bumper sticker version of what I think ultimately happens to people if they start thinking.
No, the data suggests.
Yeah, and
this
the
is
data
what
is
happens.
Right. Because, well, that's the thing. If you look at any of Bernie's tweets, look at any of Ilhan, you know, only believe all women, believe all black people, blah, it's like none of it means anything. Believe all women. Really? So every woman is naturally a truth teller.
Sure.
So believe all black people or whatever it is. It's like, that's crazy. The same way, believe all white people. Imagine if someone started saying that, believe all white people, believe all men. We would think these things are crazy, but they've just tricked us into these bumper sticker things that if you think about it for 2 seconds, make no sense.
But I don't have it at my fingertips, but the right, I mean, the wild shit that has been put out by senators, you know, people in the House. I mean, if we're talking about wild shit that's been sort of perpetrated, the right is just as guilty of this.
Well, but see, that's the thing. First off, again, it's funny how this always gets framed. It's just the nature of it. If you start talking about the left, people then think that
what I'm saying is that people unfortunately are fallible, and we have a system like we've never had before over the last 7 years that allows your dumb instantaneous thoughts to be projected out into the world, and we're all guilty of it as humans.
So that's why the subtitle of the book is Thinking for Yourself in an Age of Unreason, because I'm not even sitting here telling you specifically or anyone listening to this that I want you to believe all of the things that I'm putting out here, but check them for yourselves. I mean, watch interviews you can watch my interview with Thomas Sowell if you want to learn something about economics, but you don't have to watch mine. I mean, there's a million other interviews of his out there. Like, there's so many other places, but this sort of brings it back to where we started, which is it's on you to figure these things out. But what I would say again is that what I think is happening on the right now is sort of a defense of American, it's oddly a defense of American liberalism. So I went to West Palm Beach. I spoke at a Turning Point USA event. Turning Point it's the largest college conservative gathering, largest college conservative group. This was their largest gathering, their end of year thing, right before Christmas. So this is like 3 or 4 days after the impeachment started. And I spoke in the morning, and then it was announced the night before that Trump was going to speak there. So I spoke in the morning, and then a bunch of speeches were canceled, and then Trump spoke. So basically, I spoke right before Trump. And I was in the audience when Trump spoke. I was right there. And it's interesting when you see these things for real as opposed to what the media gives you on them. So Trump goes up there for like an hour and a half, and, you know, he has a teleprompter, but he's, you know, just veering in and out, and he goes on his like crazy tangents and all that. But you've been around a lot of stand-ups. The guy really, in many ways, is a stand-up. Not the world's greatest stand-up, but a very effective stand-up. So he does this thing up there about how he's like, you know, he starts talking about windmill technology, and he's like, you know, I know more about windmills than anybody. I've studied windmills and blah, 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 windmills. And then I turned to David and I was like, you know, I guarantee you the headlines tomorrow are all going to be Trump knows more about anybody than windmills. About windmills, right? Knows more about windmills than anybody. And of course, that's what it was. But if you listen to the context of the full speech, he's joking purposely. I know more about windmills than everybody. Everybody in the audience laughs. No one taking him literally. Anyway, but if you just do the headline thing, which again gets to the way we consume news, right? And that we never read the articles, we just get the headline. Then it's like, oh, Trump says Trump's a liar. He obviously has never studied windmills. Anyway. After the event, Trump Jr. is there, and I've become kind of friendly with him, and he's been on my show, and he said, would you and David like to join me and Kimberly Guilfoyle, his girlfriend, at dinner tonight at Mar-a-Lago? So we go to dinner at Mar-a-Lago, and Mar-a-Lago is just like a scene like you can't even imagine. I mean, first off, the Secret Service, and you got to go from one place to a golf cart, and cars are checked, and all of that stuff. You go in, there's a room, a main room. Well, you know, it's over the top. It's like Trump, you know, it looks like Trump's hair and like the whole place, it's gold and shiny and, you know, it's just everything you would think it would be. We go into the first dining room. There's maybe 60 people in there. That's the bigger dining room. And we walk through, and then there's a little four top for us in this other room. There's only about 20 people in there. And Trump is one of the people there, and he's sitting right next to us with Rudy Giuliani, and Melania is there. Anyway, we have a really nice dinner. I really like Junior. I think he's funny. I think he gets it. He's fighting for what he believes in, for whatever our differences are. At the end of the meal, he says, you want to meet my dad? I was like, yeah, I'd like to meet the president. So we walk up to Trump. He's sitting there. This is 2 or 3 days after impeachment has been announced. He has no tie on. He's laughing hysterically with Giuliani. They're having a ball. Meanwhile, every article is like, Trump's unraveling because of, impeachment. Junior goes up to him. He says, hey, dad, I want to introduce you to Dave Rubin. He's a great podcast, blah, blah, blah. Trump's sitting. He looks up at me and he's like, it's like, I kind of recognize you. I was like, oh, well, I'm on Tucker a lot. He goes, oh, that must be it. Then he turns to David, my husband, who's standing next to me. He goes, and who are you? And David goes, well, I'm his husband. He goes, husband? You two are married? He goes, slams his hands on the table. He goes, I want to stand up and shake both your hands. Thank you for being here. He shakes both of our hands. And he goes, I just want you guys to know that I don't give a shit. I don't think anyone else has given a shit for 20 years. And I think it's just great. Then Melania is sitting across the table and she keeps pointing at David. So he walks around the table, starts talking to her. And then Trump Jr. gets pulled aside for a second. So now it's just me and Trump. And we had about 10 minutes and we talked about politics. And at the time, Bloomberg was just at the beginning of getting in. And we talked about a bunch of stuff. And the guy was totally nice and friendly and whatever. So the point of all that is, I think a lot of the anti-gay stuff that we think is on the right, I think is just sort of made up. And Trump is the first president to ever come in as a first term president and be for gay marriage. They're not coming for the gays. They're really not. They're not. But, and it doesn't mean that there isn't, again, some religious somebody somewhere. But, you know, we could play another version of this, which would be, you know, that you've got Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and all these people screaming about gay rights. And do either one of their mosques ever have done a gay wedding? Of course not. Right? Of course not. But no one's going to talk about that.
I mean, it feels like a false equivalency in the respect of, like, how did gay marriage get pushed through? Like, was it on any Republican agendas over the last?
No. So I've talked about this many times. Republicans completely, look, both sides often, almost always fail to live up to their standards. So I would have preferred years ago, Republicans, the libertarians really should have been screaming. The guy who really failed here was Rand Paul. Rand Paul is the number one libertarian in the Senate, and he should have been screaming for years about gay marriage, at least at a states' rights level. It would have been perfectly congruent with his set of ideas. I believe in states' rights, limited government. I want people to live how they want to live. He should have been screaming, but he has to remain a Republican for election purposes, so he didn't do it. Now what the Republicans mostly do, and by the way, I mean this with my friends, so like Dennis Prager and Ben Shapiro, now they take the libertarian approach. Now that gay marriage happened and they see that the ship has sailed, they're like, oh, well, I just don't want the government involved. Now, they didn't really take that position. So you're totally right that both sides have a certain set of ideals and almost always fail to live up to those ideals. That being said, nobody's screaming about it. Something happened and it changed, you know?
Your contained, and I would say this too, and I found this to be true, that like a guy who lives in a part of the world who has no interaction with, as far as he knows, gay people, gay marriage and whatnot, can easily vote to what his best interest is and what he might believe on a core level, which is like perhaps gay people don't deserve the same rights.
Right.
But if put in a room with you or Ellen or anyone else, oh, they're good gays.
Yeah. I don't think lesbians should have the same rights. That's
fair
a whole
enough.
Other story.
We,
and that's a bit much.
But like, they would never, ever have the balls or the gall to tell them what they really believe. So it's like face to face, people are rarely as strong as they are behind the veil of the internet or
whatever. I just realized I should be more funny here. I'm being too serious.
No,
I'll start being funny now. But
did you coin the phrase the intellectual dark web?
So Eric Weinstein actually came up with the phrase, but it was sort of born in my garage.
But I'm interested, and if you look at, and I'm a big fan of all you guys, from you to Shapiro, like even, you know, I'm a lefty lib Democrat. Yeah. I listen to Ben for counterpoint, like just so I can make sure that I'm not like completely off my rocker. Yeah. and you look at, and even like, you know, obviously Peterson, but Rogan has been put in that category too. And like you hear Rogan, right? Who like you guys can chop it up and like agree on so many things.
Sure.
But he basically endorsed Bernie. One of his biggest endorsements.
It was a little odd, the whole thing, though, because all he really said was that Bernie's been consistent over the years.
And if he was going to vote, he'd vote. If he was going to vote left, he'd vote for Bernie.
Yeah, which seems really strange to me that you could sit down with so many brilliant people like Peterson and Shapiro and all sorts of other people, and then you end up going for the socialist. But I'll discuss that with Joe some other time, I'm sure.
That's interesting. For me, I feel like you and I live in the same orbit, and I'm not done with my party. I'd rather try to fix it from the inside, and there's still a part of me that limits, you know, my ability in which to vote for Trump.
I really love that. And by the way, I have said that on my show many times. I think I started saying this before to some of my lefty guests like Sam and the Weinstein brothers. I have said this before. If you guys think that you can fix the left from the inside, go for it. And if 5 years from now, the left has suddenly reconfigured itself into a sensible, moderate party that has purged most of the bad guys and actually fights for the working class again and has some understanding of constitutional rights and all of those things, and the right has suddenly gone off the deep end and Trump destroyed the whole thing or whatever, and I have to come crawling back, I will gladly take the ending of the story. I truly mean that. I will have a mea culpa, guys, let me back in, please, and blah, blah, blah. And maybe I don't get let back in. But I actually am completely okay with that. I've had this debate privately with many of those guys many times because they see me now as someone thought of as moving to the scary right? And it's like, I see fertile ground there. I see fertile ground with people like Dennis Prager and his wife came to my house where I am married with my husband for Shabbat dinner. And now I'm supposed to be told that Dennis Prager hates gay people. You know what I mean? It's just all bananas stuff. But we already touched on all that stuff. But my point is, I have found fertile ground with these people. I love the ability to agree to disagree. I think actually what you're throwing at me here, which is freaking wonderful. This is what I love more than anything else. I mean, this, what we're doing right now, there's very few of you left. I hate to tell you that. There's very few lefties that are still willing to do this in an honest way without sitting across from someone and calling them racist and a bigot and the rest of it. So if you and a couple guys are able to fix the whole thing and say, I'm always a liberal Democrat and I'm a lefty and I'm always here and we're going to fix the damn thing, then so be it. But it seems to me that even though they've basically taken out Bernie this time, the bad ideas of leftism, of collectivism, of socialism, those are the ideas that the 16, 17, 18-year-olds are feeling right now. So if you think it's bad now, I think it's going to get much worse. And the fact that they're throwing up old, you know, partially senile Biden to be the firewall against this thing, this is almost the last gasp of the old school Democrat.
But the numbers support that there are many people like me. I think the voices of the ultra left or the
then
ultra
take them
right.
Out. Get cracking. But I really mean that.
But what I'm saying is, it's like Twitter is actually only 10% mm-hmm. of the people. Like it feels like the loudest voices, but when it comes down to it, it's like black people in the South saving us from ourselves.
Right.
Like every turn.
So I totally hear that. And by the way, this is exactly what the election just showed us, right? Because if you were thinking on Twitter, if you were just a Twitter person, right, then you would go, wait a minute, all the Bernie bros and the support for Bernie's off the rails. You can't find one person on Twitter who likes Biden. So this wouldn't really make much sense. Well, I guess you can find a couple celebrities, but like you can't find like real like grassroots people that seem to like Biden on Twitter. But that's your point, that real people exist in the real world and Twitter is just a tiny slice of this.
Right.
I just think it will be impossible for you guys to hold the sane left. I think something has happened. The system has been fully infected and the parasite is taking over the host. But I truly wish you luck and I will always be there. Like I want, you know, Peterson would always talk about this when we were on tour. He would say, it doesn't matter if you're on the left or on the right, you want healthy tension between the sides. You want opponents, intellectual opponents that can push and pull you. And you want to feel that all the time so that you don't get the excesses of either side, right? So the excesses of the right would be, we're gonna freaking dismantle government altogether. And as I said, we're gonna end up in Mad Max, something like that. You don't want that. Maybe some libertarians want that. The excesses of the left are that the government is going to absolutely take over everything and control every facet of your life. So you want that push and pull. And by the way, the right-left thing is sort of played out at this point. I would say it's basically your libertarian or authoritarian. I don't mean libertarian like from the Libertarian Party. I mean, libertarian meaning you believe in individual rights, you believe in yourself, versus authoritarian meaning you think that somebody else, some sort of governmental bureaucratic something, knows what is good for you, something like that. But you want that. You want that. So I think it's totally honorable and decent and the rest of it. I just don't see it anymore. But who the hell knows? Yeah.
But do you think it's slightly like, it feels a little idealistic when it like using your interaction with Donald Trump or, you know, I don't know, Dennis Prager or like Shapiro in the respect of like that your interaction with them is a projection of what the feeling is in the country. Like, I don't.
What do you mean?
Like, I think it would be ridiculous for Donald Trump to do anything different than kind of what he did, right? Which was just to, you know, he's a big fan of moments like that, if you think about Trump. Like,
right. But are you saying that you don't think Donald Trump likes gay people? Or
no,
do you,
no, no,
or
no.
Do you think he's fundamentally against gay marriage or something?
I think that more...
I don't think he cares. I actually don't think he cares for a split second.
I think you would be more susceptible on that side to exactly the interaction you had, which is that most people would have you over for dinner and they would vote against your interest.
I just genuinely don't see it anymore. I know what you're saying. We sort of hit on this before, but well, first off, the gay marriage thing, you know, what we do in America is we expand rights and then we move on. Nobody is coming to suddenly reverse gay marriage. It would be, first off, the logistical impossibility of it. You know, there would be a gajillion reasons why it would be virtually impossible to do. I don't care, truly, I really mean this. I've said this to Ben Shapiro's face in my studio. I don't care if Ben Shapiro thinks I'm a sinner. I don't care. What I want is him not to legislate my life. If his position now is I don't want the government involved, Ben is not talking about gay marriage on his show every day. He never talks about it. He only talks about it when people call him an anti-gay bigot. But it's like he does not care less,
sure.
You know? And so he's entitled to whatever his own belief system is. Jerry Falwell Jr. doesn't have to love gay marriage, but you know, did he invite me because I'm a good patsy for him to be able to speak with no reservations to his 14,000 students? I mean, is he so freaking brilliant and I'm just like some idiot wandering around like talking to people that are seemingly nice? I just don't think that's the case. I think these people have changed.
But it's part of it, right? It's got to be.
I see so much more hatred on the left that it's so hard for me to understand that now. And yet I used to think the way you think. So I'm really trying to get there. The amount of hate that I get from lefties every single day is unimaginable. But I thought they're supposed to be for gay people. But, you know, like...
But they're not hating you for being gay.
Well, no, a lot of them, oh, you're a self-hating gay. I get that one a lot. I'm a self-hate. I must hate myself because I'm gay because other people seem to not care about my marriage and you guys
vehemently
are obsessed with it. But they want to use it as a crudgel. They want to say, see, we fought for gay marriage, so you better freaking stay on your knees forever. I mean, they really want gay people to stay on their knees forever. There's a gay joke in there that I'll just let be. But you know what I mean? That's,
please
that's
give what, it. Kevin wants it.
Kevin. But that's what they want. They think if we give you equality, we own you forever. That's why if you try to walk as a gay person, me, if you try to walk as a black person, Candace, you try to walk away from it once they've given you equality. They didn't give me equality. That's the thing. In the United States, you are born free. The government did not give you freedom. The government protects your freedoms. This is very different than every country in the history of the world. We are born free. The government protects those rights. The government didn't make you free because that means a man made you free. You are free by the nature of reality. You are free by, it is your birthright as a human being. And that's what our founding document said. They're unalienable rights. We have God-given rights. That is very different than saying the government made you free, but they can't stand when somebody walks. So we're for women, we're for brown people. They really don't like Nikki Haley. She's, I believe she's Indian. She was the governor of South Carolina, a southern state, right? She's probably going to run for president in 2024. I would support her in a second, but I'm not supporting her because she's brown and I'm not supporting her because she's a woman. I'm supporting her because I think she's got a lot of good ideas, but they don't want you to walk. that walk free. So they have to extract a really high cost because they can't just let black people know, you know, black people, Republicans don't hate you, because then you might start exploring some of their ideas and you might be a black person that wants to be a small business owner. And you go, wait a minute, if I'm a small business owner, I might want low taxes so I can employ more people and buy more capital and start building a bigger business.
But we've
those are Republican ideas.
But we've seen religious, I mean, all the data suggests that like certain sectors, like especially religious Latin people, but there's like, you know, there's Latin support for Donald Trump. There's black. I mean, but that's always been, right? There's always been like a Republican base within the minorities in certain sectors, be it now or 20 years ago.
Sure.
So it's growing. Like, so it's not a reaction. They're not reacting to the fact that they were like pushed out of the only sort of the only political body that they thought they could be a part of.
Well, no, but I would say it's rapidly expanding, and I don't think people realize how crazily it's expanding.
Do you think you would be as passionate about your belief system if it hadn't unlocked an income stream for you?
I mean, I've never really thought about that before, but
it's worth thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah, because I've always... Well, let's put it this way. I would be doing it no matter what. I know I would be doing it no matter what. Because the way that I go about my life, this everything that I'm saying to you is true. I'm not trying to get you. I'm not trying to confuse you. I'm actually, and as I think I said this a couple of times, I'm not even really trying to convince you to believe any of the things that I'm saying here. I think we can let this conversation sit and some people will listen and go, oh, you know, Dave made a couple of points. Maybe I'll check out that interview with Thomas Sowell or whatever. It's a function, I think, that I... This is what I would say. It's a function that I'm doing what I think I'm supposed to be doing, that success has come. I think if you do what you're supposed to be doing, what you're passionate about, success will come. But it doesn't mean you can do it tomorrow. I had a lot of seriously shitty years of doing stand-up in New York City, standing on street corners, handing out tickets in rain nor sleet nor snow. You know what I mean? Like there was one night I was out there, some massive, you know, barking. I'm sure you've talked to many comics about it. And like where you 2 hours of just handing out tickets. So you get 5 minutes of stage time and it's a freaking nightmare and it's horrible. And it's like borderline suicidal. And
bringer shows,
at least you can drag a couple of your friends to, and you don't have to stand outside. That's the next version of the nightmare though. Cause eventually you run out of friends. Cause basically you blow your load when you're not a great comic. And then by the time you're good, nobody wants to come anymore. It's too late. And it's funny. I'm in a really weird spot with stand-up now, which is I did it for like 12 years in New York and I was pretty good. And I was one of the youngest comics ever passed at the Cellar. And I did some good stuff. But then I came here and started doing something totally different. And I wasn't that funny in this conversation. And it's like, now when I was on tour with Jordan, if we had an off night in a city, I would just do the local club, but I'd do an hour and I sold out every gig that I did. And it's funny, I don't even care about it that much, which is a really weird thing also. Cause when I loved it and I was living it, you know, it's like you can get three people to show up to your show or whatever. And it's like now, because of this other thing that I do, I get to exercise the stand-up thing again. So when I go on tour, it's going to be like half stand-up, half lecture, half Q&A. But it's more just like I kind of get up there and just, it's more like I'm running a circus or something. There was a point there that I lost after all that. See, I'm making fun of...
Attend it there.
Yeah, that sounds right.
That was it. That was Dave. Again, this conversation was at the end of February, before sort of a lot of the current political situation had revealed itself. So in case you're wondering, or in case you forgot, we recorded this at the end of February. Anyway, Dave, thank you for being on the show. If you want to check out his book, there's a link in the liner notes. Love you guys. See you next week.